I'd like to introduce our speaker this morning, Eric Storley. Eric is one of the founders of the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. He is also a teacher at the University of Minnesota Center for Healing and Spirituality, and he's an author. The book's title is Nothing on My Mind?
Nothing on My Mind.
And he speaks here occasionally, and we are pleased to have him for it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good to be here. Opening chant.
Go. I'll follow.
Prayers to touch a deep and subtle karma, having it to see and hear, remember and become. We vow to taste the truth that is right here and yet so far beyond words.
Well, could you throw me that fatter pillow? I think it'll help my
old knees, which have had 3 surgeries already. See you all. Or I should say thank you for welcoming me here. I was sorry not to be here for the sitting before the talk. Usually it's my rule to come and sit with everybody before I talk, but with yoga teacher Carolyn Hadeen had led her yoga and meditation retreat all day yesterday down in Red Wing, and then my wife and I had a dinner plan that I could not escape and didn't really want to, so I was still trying to gather thoughts at 8:30. My thoughts gather very slowly. It's a shame. And then I made the mistake as I left of suggesting to my wife, who'd had the courtesy to go to the retreat with me all day, that she ought to meditate more. And she said, I won't quote the whole phrase, but it was basically, you are full of, you know, so supply your own now. So I was somewhat chastened before coming here. And I don't recommend preaching too often to others about how they ought to meditate more. It doesn't work too well. All right, come on in. I talked here about a year ago, and I think I mentioned something from Icue's Skeletons, which really struck me a few years ago when I was giving a talk at Common Ground. So even though I may be repeating myself, let me read this again. So, Icue, a Japanese kind of trickster, Zen monk, wanderer, was talking about he was telling the story of the Buddha's teaching about enlightenment where the Buddha holds a flower. So here's Icue. When you listen to Gautama's preaching, Gautama Buddha's preaching of more than 50 years, and practice exactly as Gautama preached, It is just as he taught at his last preaching when he said, and so this is Ikkyu presumably quoting the Buddha, "From beginning to end, I've preached not a single word," unquote. And then the Buddha holds out the famous flower, which brought a faint smile to Kashyapa's lips, his disciple. At that time, he told Kashyapa, "I have the exquisite mind of the right Dharma, and with it I acknowledge your understanding of the flower." When asked what he meant, Gautama said, "My preaching of the Dharma for more than 50 years, may be likened to saying, there is something in your hand. In order to bring near a small child, you want to take in your arms. My 50 years and more of Dharma preaching have been like a beckoning. That is why the Dharma I transmit is like the taking up of a child to my breast." So the preaching, my preaching of the Dharma for more than 50 years may be likened to saying there is something in your hand, I must have missed that, in your hand, in order to bring near a small child, you want to take in your arms. The Dharma I transmit is like the taking up of a child to my breast. So I love this because it really explains how transitory and difficult all of this talk is. So basically we can give elaborate talks about Buddhism or the Dharma or Christianity or whatever, but in some sense we're simply attracting people to try to find something close to our hearts, some opening. And of course when you attract a small child by pretending to have something in your hand, when you open it, there's nothing there. But, you get to hug the child. How sweet. So the words in that sense are just a trick. So I'm just here wasting your time, as Click and Clack say, telling you words, but they aren't the point, and yet they are very important. So here we have this old story. Talking about this. So I like to touch on that just because it, in a sense, diminishes the big deal about giving a lecture or studying or intellectual understanding of this practice, which is very important. I mean, I'm a professor, a scholar, I love it, but it can get out of hand, as we all know. So these words are, in a sense, nets that we can cast out over the waters, and we're trying to catch the moon in the net. And in the old European story of the three great sillies, fools, they saw the moon in the water and got worried it was drowning, and they got all the nets and they threw the nets and the moon kept staying in the water. So our words are like that. But they're still very useful. So we use them. And they're a way to encourage ourselves and others. I wanted to mention the pleasure I had and the pain of sitting the Rohatsu session here, 7 days. Pleasure is not quite the right word. sitting for 7 days is demanding, and we have to take care of our bodies and be very careful. But wonderfully rewarding as well. And it came to my mind at the end of the very first full day of the session, I walked out to the porch at the break, which happened to end just at sundown. And as I stood looking out the windows, there was an amazing sunset where there was a shaft of golden light that just went straight up to the sky. Somehow the clouds had held the sun in abeyance except for that one golden shaft of light. And there were a few others of us there looking at that, kind of rapt, transfixed. Does anyone else remember that first? Yeah, just phenomenal. So I thought, what a gift. On the first day, I'm still thinking many thoughts, and my knees ache a bit, but I get to walk out on the porch and just see this magnificence. So, that touches on something that we long for, experience like that. And in some sense, it brings us to the practice. It brings us to make the effort, that kind of opening. And yet, as soon as we reach for it, we're lost. It's gone. We can't reach for it. As soon as we're thinking about, oh, I think now tomorrow I'll walk out on the porch, or this is the next day I walk out on the porch and think, wow, I'm going to really get enraptured with the sunset, and then, oh, well, it's pretty cool, but I'm not rapt. What's going on? So we can't command any of these things. We work with a kind of indirection. And I was reminded at that point of a talk that Rosemary had given about the passage from the Genjo Koan, Dogen's Genjo Koan. And I think I noted that here. Yeah, so she was discussing the lines that say, practice that confirms things by taking the self to them is illusion. So if I was trying to confirm my opening and buoyancy by trotting out to the porch to see the sunset and be rapt, nah, wouldn't work. For things to come forward and practice and confirm the self is enlightenment. So somehow these things, if we practice, we sit zazen, and then sometimes we get to have this kind of opening. And that's a great encouragement. And sometimes we even get to just sit and look at the wall and be at rest, alive, delighted to be there, not even looking for a beautiful sunset. But there's this tricky transitoriness, the sense of impermanence. So I experience this every spring, and we'll be coming up to this soon in Minnesota when the lilacs come out. And I see the buds, and then I get hungry for, oh, they're going to open soon. I want them to open soon. And then they open, and I think, oh, my God, they're only going to last a day or two. I've got to hurry home and sit by the lilacs. And then I've interfered. My mind has interfered with the whole experience, the rapture, the rapt, the being caught A raptor is a bird that catches you. So when we're rapt in a sunset, that sunset comes to us. We don't go to it. And I think that was what Dogen was trying to get at. We can't force anything. All we can do is practice and be open, and then maybe the lilacs are there. And then they disappear, and then the apple blossoms. But I still think, oh my God, they're only going to be here for a week. I've got to enjoy them, and that gets in the way. But that Japanese sense of wabi-sabi, of transitoriness, is also part of the beauty. I mean, if I had lilacs perennially in bloom in my front yard, smelling beautifully 365 days a year, they'd become woodwork. So something about this movement of opening and closing happens with our sitting. So sitting can be very unpleasant. Our minds get busy. Our knees may hurt. We're not happy in the moment. And of course, that's the definition of suffering. I'm sitting here in this moment wishing I were in another moment. Come on, hurry up, next moment. It's only, let's see, how many more minutes till the bell? And we do that all the time. So the discipline, the practice, which Dogen says is already awakening, whether we know it or not, and often we don't, is simply an opportunity, just an opportunity. So during the session, for a while I got focused on the wonderful quote from Dogen under the bell there. The sound that issues from the striking of emptiness is an endless and wondrous voice that resounds before and after the fall of the hammer. The sound that issues from the striking of emptiness, from the hitting of the bell or the han, the sound that issues from the striking of emptiness, well, that's our zazen. We sit here, we're striking the bell of just being. No, nothing added. No assignment. That's the beauty of the Soto Zen practice I learned from Suzuki and Katagiri. No koan, no image of a deity. Just be here. Be here. Whoever you are, in all your simplicity, complexity, stupidity, wonder. So the sound that issues from the striking of emptiness is an endless and wondrous voice that resounds before and after the fall of the hammer. So I got up from my seat and I walked into the porch, and that was resounding when I was open to a sunset. It was resounding. That was emptiness. And then, of course, I smell food. And that experience has to be released. Has to be released. It's like opening your hand and a butterfly lights. You can't hang on. You just have to let it go when it's ready to go. But we can cultivate. We can cultivate this openness. So there's a kind of longing we have, and our desire, which the Buddha says is the root of all our trouble, desire, craving, greed. So what do we do with this longing, this craving, this greed, though, that makes us want to wake up? So you might say that's the last desire. I mean, I'm filled with desire all the time. I have a desire to advise my wife. It didn't work out. That's fine, you know. But there's this, and I prefer the word longing because there's a kind of longing for beauty and openness and freedom that isn't negative. If we didn't have that, why would we come here? If we didn't have a longing to open up, to expand, to be fulfilled. So we have that. The old Puritan mystic Jonathan Edwards described this as the beauty of God. And he said the beauty of God was like gravitation. So the closer you got to the beauty, the faster you fell, and the closer you got to the beauty. And that's what attracted the Christian soul to salvation or liberation. Beauty, beauty, the beauty of the ineffable, the infinite, the Buddha Dharma, the God, the Godhead, this universe we sit in, the sunset. So practice, again, Dogen says, practice that confirms things by taking the self to them is illusion. We're grasping. For things to come forward and practice and confirm the self is enlightenment. So we could say, I had a little moment of enlightenment, kensho, awakening, whatever we want to call it. And that was a gift, free gift. I didn't own it. Can't sell it. Can't just... But I can practice. I can make myself available over time to have this kind of freedom. Now, Tim tells me you're all studying the Genjo Koan, so I do have to say that the later lines where Dogen says this is not like a reflection in a mirror or the moon on the water have always puzzled me. So when you guys figure those lines out, let me know. I've asked Katagiri, he didn't satisfy me. I asked Shohaku, he said, I don't know. But then I looked at his book and he's decided he knows now. Since it's a key to the Genjo Koan, so but they don't quite agree. The Masao Abe trans interpretations and Shohaku, but very interesting, very interesting. So we are like mirrors. So I reflected that beautiful sunset, which was out there. But it arose within me, my visual cortex, my eyes, my optic nerves. I felt some delight that was me all bound up with something out there. So this longing, desire, craving, it's part of us and it moves us to be here, to practice, to get up in the morning, practice. But over time, the good news for those of you who are just considering whether you would engage in this folly of Zazen, all I can tell you is that we have thousands of years of records and stories that, going back to the Upanishads and the Hindu tradition, recommending this and saying, you know, this is a good thing. This is a good thing. This can save you a lot of trouble. You might reduce your bills, your psychiatric bills. But I say that carefully because one of our early delusions when we were practicing Zen in the 60s and 70s was that, oh, this fixes everything. Just meditate, fixes everything. Didn't. You know, there's a level of trouble that where we need all the help we can get, which includes psychiatry, counseling, psychotherapy, group work, all the wisdom of both East and West to try to address those things. We may need meds. We may not, but we can't. Zazen was not, as many of us found out after a couple of people here committed suicide in the 70s, this wasn't the answer for them. We didn't really help them long term. But having put ourselves together to the point that we can live in this world, function well, then this is a way to really embrace everything. Our suffering, the pain. And I felt this strongly over the last weeks as I read about Libya. And I would read about Libya and I would feel rage. Well, now in Buddhist thinking, anger is a bad thing. It's one of the three poisons. But I couldn't think of any other more appropriate immediate response to Gaddafi than rage. Same with someone like Hitler or Stalin. So it's very simplistic to say, oh, don't be angry. No, anger is a very useful function. I'm sure all of you at some point have been in the kitchen, you opened a cupboard door on the wall cabinet, you bent over, you came up, and wham, out of the blue, you didn't know what was going to happen, a very hard, sharp, painful blow to the head. Now, when that happens to me, anger comes up. Now, if it doesn't for you, interesting, very interesting. But for me, anger comes up. And then I realize what I've done. Now, that's just the fight-flight mechanism. That's protective. That's what has kept us alive. That's kept us from walking in front of a bus. Or it reminds me to close the cupboard door. And, you know, so, but then, where can we go with that? Because the anger is toxic and painful, hard. And I think what's so important about this practice is that I could feel that anger and then I could let it move into just a kind of open space of compassion. Oh my God, this is so hard. And I'm not going to refuse to know about it. But I can't do anything. You know, all I can do is be open to that pain. So we're not, you know, we have beautiful sunsets, we have Gaddafi, and that's all part of what we have to be able to negotiate and experience. In a sense, we're caught with this practice that involves real effort and very indefinable effort. Sit down and just be here. And in the Soto tradition, when the mind wanders, find the breath. Locate yourself again. locate yourself again. The breath is always in this moment. If the breath were in the future or past and not here, we'd be dead. So you can rely on the breath. It's your friend. It's your ally. It's always here. So again and again, we can just come back to this moment. And the more we come back into this moment, the broader and bigger it can become. But we have to move through boredom, irritation, restlessness, all those obstructions that are actually good news. So what are the obstructions again? There's craving. You want to have good thoughts, or you're thinking about something you want. Aversion, thinking about sitting in Zazen, thinking about the person who just insulted you. Don't want to think about that. Restlessness, just the body can't settle. The body can't settle. It takes a long time of sitting for the body really to settle and be willing to deeply go into relaxation. See, aversion, greed, restlessness. Oh, my favorite, sloth. As the British would say, sloth, slothfulness, laziness. And what's interesting to me is the laziness in my own mind. When I'm sitting here and my mind wanders to something attractive, oh, I was praised by so-and-so. And then I think, come on, back to the breath. And then the mind says, I don't want to. No, I don't want to make that effort. It's such a delicate effort. It's not even using a muscle. But the act of the will to bring the mind back can be exhausting, and we get lazy about that. And of course, then there's the basic laziness of, well, I'm kind of tired, and let's go to bed. But we all need sleep, so that most of us are sleep deprived, so it's a good thing to get that sleep. Well, in this theme of longing for, what can we call it? Longing for awakening, longing for enlightenment, which Dogen says is, if you long enough to practice, then you're enlightened already, whether you believe it or not. When you assume the position, take the moment and sit with yourself and be as present as you can, making the effort to bring the mind back here again and again. He insists that that's it. You're now awake. That's waking up. Being willing to bring the mind back again and again. And that can deepen and deepen and deepen, and then it can get shallow. As I was sitting over there, and many of those Zazen periods, my mind was kind of drifty. Yeah. But we can keep doing it. Keep doing it. So I wanted to just get out of the Zen mode and bring you a wonderful poem by Rumi. And it's fascinating that Rumi is now the most popular poet in America. Unfortunate for my daughter and other American poets who are poets, but there's this deep hunger in our culture for the mystical, for the opening, for the freedom, for that sunset, for a good life, for enlightenment. One night a man was crying. Oh, by the way, Rumi was born in Afghanistan. His family fled one of the Khans. I don't know if it was Genghis Khan. they went to Turkey, and then he grew up and lived in Turkey. One night a man was crying, "Allah, Allah." His lips grew sweet with the praising. Very interesting. His lips grew sweet with the praising. So, since we're not Muslims and we don't chant too much, I mean, our praising is to come here and assume the position. An act of great, great optimism and strength to say, just me as I am right now is sufficient. I am sufficient. I do not need X, Y, or Z. I do not need the Lexus, the advanced degree, the income boost. Now, I'm very practical. At some level, we need things, and we get them, and of course, we have careers, we have families, we have children. We do what we need to do, and that's what we should do. But beyond that, there's a kind of release of our neediness that happens when we can say, well, for 40 minutes, I can just be here with my suffering or my joy or my boredom or whatever it is and taste that deeply. Be with that deeply. So I think as we do our zazen, maybe not just our lips, our whole body can get sweet with the praising that's implicit with just coming to rest here. That's a kind of praising of existence, of the universe, of the right to be here and fully enjoy our life and living and embrace everything. Even if it's katafi, at some level, know that suffering and not run from it, not flee from the hard things, accept what comes. One night a man was crying, "Allah, Allah." His lips grew sweet with the praising. Until a cynic said, "So, I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? I've heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response?" That's what many people said to me when I first started sitting. What the hell? I mean, what's the point? What are you getting out of this? Why would you do this? And I wasn't quite sure, but from, I think, the first time I encountered Suzuki, I felt something very deep that was there. So I was never troubled much with that obstruction of cynicism. So did I mention cynicism? Number 5. Greed, aversion, sloth, agitation, restlessness, and cynicism. And the good news about these is that they've been going on for thousands of years. That is what happens to human beings when they sit down and contemplate. All of these things come up. You're not unique. Everybody has this. A cynic said, "So, I've heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response?" The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep. He dreamed he saw Kidder, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Well, Kidder is kind of like a prophet or a saint in the Quran. Kidder says in his dream, "Why did you stop praising?" "Because I've never heard anything back." Well, have any of you ever sat 40 minutes and thought, what the hell? Why am I doing this? Is this going anywhere? Is there any real point to this? When am I going to be fully enlightened and I'll people will respect me and I'll get famous and levitate, you know, I'll really be noticed. And then you're just sitting there, your ratty old self, wondering why you're there. So that can happen in sessions especially. Why did you stop praising? Because I've never heard anything back. And Kidder says, this longing you express is the return message. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. So it's our suffering, really, that kicks us in the pants and says, we better figure something out. Life is not going well. Well, I've read about Buddhism and meditation. We can try that. Maybe that'll work. Christian church didn't help. Islam didn't help. My psychiatrist didn't help. Nothing helped. And I think all of those are important. I don't think any of us should leave our root religion, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Wiccan, because we can meditate. We can meditate, and that can rest on top of this deep experience. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. So we can make this effort at home or here or in the wilderness to sit down and be with ourselves and, in a sense, digest our sadness. Experience our grief, our wants. We can never fulfill all of our wants. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. That's kind of weird, but interesting. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. So it's our longing. My longing for that sunset. That's encouragement. I think, well, you know, I'll sit down and be boring old, arrogant Eric, annoying my wife. But if I'm patient, if I stay with this, a lot of that can just flow away. I can just be here. I can just be here. I might even apologize. I don't do that well. I don't like to apologize. You think I should apologize? Would you recommend this? Lee, would you recommend an apology?
Yeah.
Yes? Oh, okay. Okay. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. So we all need to be love dogs. Love dogs. Whining for the connection. the connection. So, of course, the Sufis are all about, oh, let me be God. Let me be God. So many of them were executed. That's heresy. You can't be God. You've got to worship God. But the Sufis want to be God. Big trouble. That's like, as I mentioned, I think, in my last talk here, that was Meister Eckhart's problem in the Middle Ages. He said he wanted to, that the Trinity and all things were just kind of floating on the surface of something unified and total that included him. And of course, that didn't go over well in Rome. Gets in the way of religious organization. So, I think at the bottom, this longing, we need to have deep respect for it. There's this paradox in Hinduism, Buddhism, all religions. Craving and greed are the poison that never lets us be satisfied. And yet, it's what can pull us toward not being satisfied, but in some way letting go, being here, opening vast emptiness, and nothing holy, as Bodhidharma is said to have said. So then we can walk out and the sunset is there, and wonderful. And maybe this year when the lilacs come, I won't be hankering for them to stay longer. But I always do. I bet I do this year. But okay, so I can accept that too. Yeah, beauty is very attractive. And I can long for it. And then I can enjoy it, and then I can do better at letting it pass. So in this kind of open sitting where we might count breaths, or we might do some kind of koan study. I think just once Katagiri gave me a koan, and he wasn't much interested. But, you know, we're finally doing a practice of beyond any particular object. We're not praying to a certain deity. We're not doing a mantra. We use the breath as an ally, not because we should sit here counting breaths. One, two. I mean, that's an anchor and a useful way to remind ourselves to come back. But then, eventually, that can open and we can let it go. And in that experience, something called the immeasurables in Buddhism can come into play. Just friendliness, openness to others, less competition, empathy for their good fortune, sympathetic joy. Well, that's very hard for most humans, me especially, in an academic world. You know, someone else writes an article that gets attention and you think, Jesus. Well, whatever. You know, didn't deserve it, but... So, you know, we have to work, we have to really settle to say, oh, good for him. That's great. Good, good, good. And compassion. I mean, that's very difficult. How do we open to the terrible suffering in the world? How do we let that in without it injuring us? And it's something about just being open to everything, letting the pain be our pain, knowing that we can't fix it. And our own pain, our own toxicities, letting them in, not having to repair everything. So a lot of this is in the 12 steps, if any of you, I've never been in AA, should have been at different times. But, you know, a lot of that is there in the Serenity Prayer. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. So, let's all be love dogs. Let the longing move us to the effort of practice that can simultaneously sometimes just become effortless. So my moment looking at the sun set was effortless. That's why it was so beautiful. I wasn't trying to make it more beautiful or worrying about, the sun's going to go down and it'll just be gray. So that was a moment of just, how wonderful. Thank you. A gift. I don't own it. I don't own it. But I can be here with it for a moment, and it can pass. So, we're getting close to 11. Any questions, comments, observations, riddles? Yeah.
Those teachers that you mentioned, don't even
Good question. Very interesting question. I mean, that's a fascinating question as to what the hell this term enlightenment refers to. And I've never met the Buddha. I don't know. And if I met him, would I know? You know, there's a lot, it's a very troubling notion, because to say someone is enlightened freezes something in time. So it's like an iceberg. And as a young practitioner, I always thought, well, I'll become enlightened and then my passport is punched and I'll be perfected and that's it. It hasn't happened yet. I'm waiting, but actually I'm not waiting. So, that's fascinating. I mean, there's no answer. There's no answer. What we could say, or what I can say, is that the practice opens wider and wider and wider. And is that enlightenment? Why not? Katagiri, I once heard him say to a group of high school kids when asked over southeast, some kid asked, oh, well, are you enlightened? I said, yes. But then, in Buddhist doctrine, we're all enlightened. So what did he mean? I also knew him very closely. I worked with him very closely, and I saw many flaws, many problems, huge problems. So, in some sense, that's a wonderful intellectual question, but in the meantime, I think all we can do is experience this huge mind we all have that reflects this vast universe and enjoy it. Be a love dog. So, I don't know if I must not be enlightened, but I think sometimes I'm a love dog. Yeah.
Thank you for mentioning the sunset during the Hatsu. When I wasn't in the kitchen, I had a good portion sitting next to you for that week.
Yeah.
And I also want to thank you for your insight into the love dog poem, which has been bothering me for about 4 years. I've always wondered about that because of the Buddhist relationship of longing.
Yeah.
And the emphasis on it. Those words resonated so deeply with me when I was sitting with that poem. There's something here I'm not figuring out.
Yeah.
He talks about the elixir is hidden in the poison, so come to the poison. Oh, there's a relationship with longing, there's a relationship with desire that can be supported.
Yeah.
And this is really making sense to me.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's very tricky because the words can't capture all of that. I mean, it's longing and desire that bring us to the most strict of Zazen schedules where we're saying, I will never desire anything. Well, what are you doing here then? You're desiring something. So I really love the Sufis because of bringing the emotional quality in and emphasizing the grief. And then the compassion is the grief for the world. I think we have to feel that or we're locked in. No, I don't want to know about that. Just stay here. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh, wait. Say the first part again.
The term is the more is love of the dog or love of the thing.
Love of the...
Love is.
Love is a dog?
Yeah.
Or love is a bitch? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. But what would we be without it? So the compassion is all about love. Of recognizing every other being as us. And if we can't, you know, if we can't heal ourselves, we can't ever, I mean, what can block us from that compassion even for the insanity of Gaddafi is that we still probably can't come to terms with our own craziness, our own cruelties. And I mean, this is not something that just happens. Oh, now I'm compassionate. No, every day I may have to, I do have to try to reach for compassion, open myself to it, not just reject things that I hate. Read the newspaper, and your compassion shrinks. Mine does, and then I have to step back. Other comments, questions, observations? Yeah.
Well, this is going back to the beginning, but kind of early on you said something about your thoughts gathering slowly, and I think it's a bit of a joke, but it was like this, anyway, I think that your thoughts gather slowly is a blessing. I mean, if you think about it, the fact that we have thoughts at all is a miracle, because otherwise we wouldn't be here. We would be under the ground or in the sky, or we would have transformed into flowers. And I think this practice is about stopping, resting, calming, healing, slowing down, and being here now in the moment. And only if we're in the present moment, then wisdom here and there arises, and then it goes, and then it comes, and then it goes. So I think thoughts coming slowly is beautiful. I mean, usually our thoughts are like, you know, and anybody who sat for a while, I mean, you sit down, you're like, geez, sometimes you're just bombarded. So that's a blessing. That's a blessing. You're very lucky your thoughts come slowly. And yeah. May everyone in this room, may our thoughts come slowly.
Yeah. But we want them to come because, as you say, without them we wouldn't, we'd be under the ground.
Right, it's the mind's function.
Yeah.
So we can't.
Yeah.
We can't not love our thoughts.
Yeah. So the practice involves learning to develop, in a sense, a new relationship to thought. We can't stop them. That's exhausting. I mean, you might for a little while, but, however, we can avoid, we can begin to learn how not to be bullied by our thoughts. So Suzuki Roshi used to say, the mind is a bully, by which he meant we have all these pushy thoughts that will push us to action, make us do things that aren't useful, that are maybe hurtful. So watching those thoughts but not having to act on them is a great expansion of our capacity as humans. Any other observations, comments, you all very much. Pleasure to be here.